The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
Ali Ansari is Professor of Iranian History and Director of the Institute for Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. He's one of the leading authorities on modern Iran and has written widely on Iranian politics, history and relations with the West. And he joins me now on the line. Ali, good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Now, first of all, and maybe this is an impossible question to answer, can you tell me where you think we are with regard to any kind of peace talks or ceasefire?
Well, to sum up, we're sort of between a rock and a hard place, really, at the moment. Neither side is budging. Both sides think they've done better than they probably have. And both are basically, you know, angling and waiting for a time when the other side will give them a better deal. The irony here is, actually, to be honest, is that probably Trump would probably be willing to take some sort of deal, some sort of lesser deal than the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, who are now looking to get some sort of maximalist deal, which I don't think the Americans or certainly Trump can deliver to them. So it's we're in an interesting impasse at the moment.
Now, we're told that there's a one-page deal on offer from the Iranian side. And, you know, the cynics say, well, that's all Trump can really absorb. No point in going for a JCPOA 200-page document because he simply won't read it. So that would be simply a series of bullet points.
Well, yes. And I mean, I think the pages are coming from both sides, actually. I mean, I think the Americans had put down a 15-point thing and someone else had put down, you know, 7 or 10 or whatever it is. I mean, none of these are going to solve the problem. I mean, all these are really trying to do is to set down a template for longer term negotiations. And this is the problem for both of us, really. I mean, for both sides, insofar as they're expecting to get the blockade or the Straits of Hormuz open. And neither side are willing to sort of countenance that until you get to the final deal. But of course, the final deal could be months down the line. I mean, this is the problem, and it's you know, for both sides, there are problems there. I mean, I don't think either side is really in a position. I think we're probably more aware of the economic difficulties it will cause us in the Western world than, I suppose, in some ways, the Revolutionary Guards in Iran are paying as much attention to the economic difficulties that will be placed on Iran.
I remember at the time of the negotiation of the Good Friday Agreement, the line was nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. But there is a thesis being put forward that you do the Strait of Hormuz first, park everything else. Now, would that work? Because Trump's imperative is to get the price of gas at the pumps down before the midterms.
Yes. So that's one of the arguments that they want to do. You know, that the Iranians will open up the straits, the blockade will be lifted, and then you'll go on to negotiate other things. But of course, you know, both sides are basically saying that they will only lift their side. You know, the Iranians will release the straits and the Americans will release the blockade once they've seen other things sort of being delivered or in good faith and so on and so forth. And at the moment, you know, there's this sort of argument that neither side is showing, or that neither side believes the other side is showing good faith. This is the problem. So it's, you know, that's one solution. I mean, another solution is to have a very sort of clear idea of a comprehensive agreement. But again, you know, what the regime in Iran needs is a massive and swift cash injection. I mean, it needs something very rapid. It's not the sort of thing, actually, that I think even with the best will in the world, the Americans can necessarily deliver. They can certainly release some frozen assets, but that would be a bit like a sticking plaster, really, for the Iranians at the moment.
Now, we remember the protests around the turn of the year, and so many ordinary people who were protesting lost their lives at the hands of the regime. Now, I suppose the stimulus for that protest seemed to be rampant inflation and also the merchants in the markets finding that the prices had gone through the roof and they couldn't get stuff that they wanted to get. And for their pains, we saw what happened. What is the likelihood that not paying your army, not paying your government officials, not paying anybody is going to lead to another chapter of that particular violence?
Well, I think it is, you know, quite likely, actually, because the problems that the regime is facing, and I think you're quite right to remind us of the sort of the economic crisis that preceded all this in some ways, because it was actually a banking crisis that triggered off the problems in the bazaar and others in late December, early January. And, you know, there's been a run in the currency, there's been massive inflation, there's a liquidity crisis. They haven't been able to pay their civil servants or even their military forces in 6 weeks. Of course, that sort of thing you can sort of sustain in a wartime situation. The minute actually you get to a deal, you transfer into a peacetime situation, it becomes even more difficult to justify some of these hardships that are taking place. And of course, I think, you know, as in any country, I mean, once that sort of economic cement starts to break down, then you're going to get fractures, and protests are likely, I would say.
Now, you have written and spoken a lot about the misunderstandings in the West about the nature of Iran, and let's call it Persia as well. The two names are pretty interchangeable, are they not?
They are.
And the question of the state versus the regime, can you parse that for me, please?
I think that one of the problems we have is, I mean, first of all, I think far too many people, certainly sort of analysts on social media, seem to have a very clear idea of where we're going and what's going to happen. And I always find this very problematic. As someone who studied Iran for over 30 years, I always say to people, you've got to be very humble in your predictions about how things are going to unfold, because there are many, many working parts of this equation. And one of the key elements, of course, is to make clear that you're distinguishing between the state, which is basically the Islamic Republic, the political system, and the wider body of society and the people. And of course, their perceptions and their objectives are quite different. I mean, while the regime itself has this strong antipathy to the West, most Iranians do not have a strong antipathy to the West and are not interested in this, you know, death or glory type of struggle that the country has been involved in for many years, actually. I mean, it's turned very hot in the last couple of years, but it's been going on for some time. And I think one of the problems people have is really in their analysis in distinguishing this and really focusing a little bit more on what people want in Iran rather than what the state wants in Iran and or what the government. And I think it's an important distinction that we need to keep in mind.
You know, the in a prison, for example, they say a prison can only work with the consent of the prisoners.
Yes.
And in the same way, a state can only work if there's some sort of social cohesion in the sense that people say, okay, we don't like this, but we're going to live with it and put up with it. How true is that in Iran?
So I think if you were to say to me 5 years ago, you know, most people in Iran would say, you know, we don't like this regime, but we'll live with it. You know, it's better than nothing and it's better than sort of chaos and this sort of thing. I think since the Women Life Freedom protests back in 2022, there's been a sort of sea change in attitudes among the Iranian population. And certainly after the massacres that happened in January and earlier this year, I think the mood music has changed completely. So you have a sort of situation in Iran where, yes, there will always be gradations of views. I mean, of course, there'll be people that will be supportive of the regime. There'll be people who will sort of be a bit ambivalent. But the number of people who literally sort of loathe what the regime stands for and represents has grown exponentially really over the last 8 to 10 months. And that's where the difference is. And it's very difficult to sort of, and I think for many of us looking from the outside in, it's often very difficult to sort of comprehend this sort of level of division that's occurred in Iranian society. And managing that and being able to repress that and control it without the sort of financial assets that you may have had previously. Because, of course, you know, you can beat up people up to a point, but you also, in order to maintain a certain amount of cohesion within society, you have to pay them off, you have to be able to pay their salaries, you have to maintain a certain degree of legitimacy, so on and so forth. And all these things are breaking down. And what the regime really has left is coercion. But, you know, this is a large country. I mean, we're talking about a country the size of Western Europe, mountainous, diverse. You know, the idea that 500,000 armed people are going to be able to just keep control of this country when everything else has broken down. You know, I find that difficult to comprehend in a way. I mean, I think people who say that need to explain how that's going to work.
So the question of where any change might come from, I mean, there was talk, you know, that it will liberalize, that there will be diplomatic breakthroughs. Was that misplaced, that belief that, you know, a fundamental, maybe slow drift towards Western thinking would happen within Iran?
I think that's absolutely right to say that within wider society, this sort of liberal, you know, Iranian society is much more liberal than the state that governs it. I mean, this is one of the great paradoxes that we have in Iran. If you look at ordinary Iranian people and what they aspire to the sort of things that we would all find familiar. But the state itself, the political system, the regime has become increasingly hardline over the years. It's not simply a result of this war. And so, you know, there is this dissonance between the two sides. And I think, unfortunately for Iran, you know, because of the tremendous turmoil that's been taking place, both politically, but also, I would say, economically and environmentally, you know, you're in a process where that process of change or transition that we are looking for is probably going to be much rockier than many of us would have liked.
Talk to me about the role of Israel in all of this. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu at the beginning, while he was being a Trump whisperer in the Oval Office, saying, you know, there will be regime change, da-da-da. And the idea that the Americans and the Israelis together, by bombing the infrastructure of the people of Iran, would somehow bring about the change and that the ordinary Iranians would love them for it. You know, there'll be a bit of pain. This is Donald Trump's mantra anyway. There'll be a bit of pain before we have resolution. I mean, is any of that true, that they could learn to love Israel?
I mean, certainly. So one of the paradoxes, again, is that even post, you know, the Gaza war and 7th of October and all this, large swathes of the Iranian population were not interested in actually the Arab-Israeli dispute. They weren't interested in Gaza. They never had the sort of antipathy towards Israel that you may have got in many Western capitals, by the way. So but that's a subject of their own particular inheritance. I mean, they've been living under an Islamist government for 47 years. They don't have the same sort of view of Israel that many, many other people may have. Now, of course, you know, after the massacre in January, there were many calls from within Iran for intervention, actually. I mean, this is what one of the most striking and astonishing things for someone like myself, who's been observing this for many years. I never in a million years would have expected to see Iranians from within Iran calling from some sort of, you know, they were saying responsibility to protect, the UN must come in, we need intervention, so on and so forth. I think the problem with all this, of course, is that, you know, from an Israeli and certainly from an American point of view, it was not properly thought through about what they were doing and how they were doing it. And clearly, as you say, this idea that you're going to get regime change from the air, or, you know, simply by bombing people or whatever, or bombing an infrastructure, it's not going to work like that. I mean, people would have said that you weaken the repressive apparatus of the regime. That way, obviously, if you weaken that and limit their ability to repress their own population, there may be opening some way down the line. But I have to say, it would happen some way down the line. It's not going to happen while the war is actually continuing. And I think some people were being extremely rosy and rather optimistic about what this all meant.
Is there a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of Iranian society and Iranian culture? I mean, I was thinking when Donald Trump was talking about ending a civilization.
Yes, I mean, that's
and the other line that has often been used, bombing a country back to the Stone Age.
Stone Age, yeah.
I mean, if America and Israel bombed Iran back 2,000 years, they would be bombing them back to a very sophisticated civilization of 2,000 years ago, would they not? So
These are idiotic and absurd comments that you often get actually from this sort of American military sort of mindset. I mean, this is sort of thing that they used to say in Vietnam, you know, I mean, the bombing back to the Stone Age and this sort of thing. And I mean, of course, it plays very badly. Of course, it plays very badly in Iran and among Iranians. And I mean, it's an absurd and stupid thing to say, particularly if you're trying to win hearts and minds in a rather sort of difficult scenario, we might add. So I think, yes, you're absolutely right. I think the messaging has been appalling. I mean, the messaging has been terrible. I mean, if you're trying to, you know, present this as some sort of like attempt at liberation, well, it doesn't help if you use that sort of language. And I said on many occasions that, you know, to use a certain amount of British understatement, you know, Donald Trump doesn't have good message discipline. I mean, this is a problem. And I think across the board, the sort of narrative, the battle of the narratives, the Iranians on the whole, and I talk about the regime here, by the way, the regime has been much better at managing its narratives than the Israelis and the Americans have been.
Which shows a level of technical sophistication that exists among people maybe employed by the regime, but young people. I mean, they're as tech savvy as their counterparts in the West.
Absolutely. And I mean, they've been very good with their social media. And I mean, you see all these sorts of, I mean, some of them are being, as you said, being run from abroad, by the way. I mean, it's not necessarily from within the country, but nonetheless, they've been very good at it. And they've always been very good at it, by the way. They've always been very good at presenting this sort of narrative and basically themselves as an underdog. And of course, all of us in the West, we all love an underdog, and it sort of helps. It obviously paints a somewhat different picture to those of us who have been looking at this rather more closely over many years. You know, that that's basically a whitewashing of what's really going on. But nonetheless, it works and it resonates and it lands on fertile ground among public opinion in the West.
I had a recent encounter with a Dublin Iranian taxi driver who was in exile from Iran, and he talked to me about the different eras in Iran, and you talked about the past, obviously, the present, the future, but there was a fourth era, the time of the Shah. Now, is that kind of rose-tinted spectacles, because the Shah was put there by the CIA and the Brits?
Well, you know, again, this is a sort of a slightly sort of a primary color reading of history, if I can put it that way. I mean, you're right up to a point, but I mean, I think also there's a view that a lot of that was done in the 50 years prior to the revolution was really to build the country up politically and economically. If not, you're absolutely right. I mean, it was very repressive by the end of the, certainly by the 70s, and this was not a democratic state. I mean, it's remarkable how Iranians these days have become extremely nostalgic over it. And all I say to people is that it tells you something about their loathing of the current situation, that they look back on the 60s and 70s with this degree of heightened rose-tinted sort of nostalgia and actually don't see some of the bad things that were taking place, because clearly there was a cause for the revolution. I mean, clearly the revolution happened for a reason. But certainly when you compare, if you're taking a historian's eye view of the history of Iran in the 20th century, I think, you would have to conclude that the revolution in 1979 did set the country back and was quite catastrophic for the people of the country. I don't think people at the time thought that, clearly not. And I think people at the time thought there would be great hope for the future. Unfortunately, like with many of these things, the promise of the revolution has not really been delivered for the vast majority of the people. That's the tragedy of it all, really.
Compounded, of course, by the destruction wrought by the Israelis and the Americans on infrastructure, on the economy generally, it will take many years for that country to get back.
I mean, you talk to people and they say, we would never have envisaged a time where Iran would be at war with Israel and America. I mean, this sort of idea is absurd to many people. I mean, they always thought that Iran was a, much more cosmopolitan, outward looking, had good relations with everyone, was building up. But now this sort of, it's true. I mean, the thing is, this whole thing is a catastrophe. I mean, it is a huge, huge tragedy for the people of Iran, above all for the people of Iran.
Ali Ansari, Professor of Iranian History and Director of the Institute for Iranian Studies at the University of St. Andrews. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show, Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.